This month's podcast features our own Deputy Director Paula Paris, who has been with JFY since 1995 when she joined the agency as Director of Development. In that role, and subsequently as Deputy Director, she has contributed to the growth and diversification of the organization for three decades. In addition to her roles at JFY, she serves as a member of the Board of Advisors for Brandeis University's Heller School of Management and Social Policy, and the Board of Trustees of Cambridge Health Alliance. In this podcast, you'll hear how her lifelong involvement in educational equity began as a bus safety monitor during the explosive year 1974, the first year of desegregation in the Boston public schools.
So the buses took us to Day Boulevard, and then they consolidated the buses and went the rest of the way with a police escort.
How JFY has helped narrow the equity gap in education before and after the pandemic era.
Not being in school affected different populations differently. That is certainly an example of equity questions, and we've made some impact on that.
And how there is still much more work to be done.
We've got a long way to go, and progress has been made for sure. But more progress needs to be made. Let's not lose sight of what we still need to do.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of blended learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by recovering learning loss and reaching and maintaining grade-level skills. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Paula Paris spent many years working in the for-profit corporate world, but found herself drawn back to the nonprofit world of social action, where she has spent the past three decades working to improve educational equity. In this conversation with JFY's Executive Director Gary Kaplan, Paula recounts many of the key moments and events that define her career as a change agent.
Good afternoon, Paula. Thank you for taking the time to do this. We have, you have quite a long history, not only with JFY, but with the whole question of educational equity. As I understand it, you've been involved in one way or another with the question of education and educational equity for quite a long time. Can you tell us where you began?
Sure. Well, just very briefly, even when I was in college in Hartford, Connecticut, majoring in music, of all things, I did on the weekends tutor high school students from Weaver High School at a church in the north end of Hartford, Connecticut. So that's sort of a thing, you know, for public service. I was just raised in a public service family. Give me service to community is just what you did, whether it was professionally or, you know, as a volunteer.
And where was that?
That was in my tutoring in Hartford, Connecticut.
But you said you were raised. Where was that?
Oh, in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Ah.
But the real hallmark was returning back to Boston, working at the Alma Lewis School of Fine Arts in Dorchester, Roxbury, Dorchester. That nexus is actually referred to as Grove Hall in postal language, but also in social language. It was on Elm Hill Avenue and Seaver Street. So I was hired as a music teacher. After a year, I was promoted to the assistant director of the music department. But because I also had ballet training, I also worked as a ballet teacher. One of the part of the mission of the Alma Lewis School of Fine Arts was not just the arts. If you came there, you took all four disciplines, but underlying all of that was kind of a place in the community. It was a social action was part of the mission. So it was using the arts as expression of the social condition. So,
Can I interrupt with a question? What were the
sure.
four disciplines? You said the four
The four
disciplines. What were they?
disciplines were, and let me make sure I've got four. So it was music, dance, drama, and sewing or costuming. So it was centered around the performance, but you just didn't come to take lessons. You came, you took a whole curriculum. When you walked in the doors, you knew that you were part of a community and that there were pe lots of people came in through there because it was a meeting place. There and Freedom House, which was only a few blocks away, were meeting places for political discussions. And most of those political discussions were around the educational situation in the Boston Public Schools in particular.
So what years are you talking about now?
I started there in 1971, which was when I graduated. Yeah. And I went right to work there. And I wanted to work there. I wanted it to be, I wanted to work in the community and I wanted to work with students. I always have had the image of artists that look like them. And that was one of the things that was happening there. But also, most of the artists that came through there, their art expressed some form of the social condition. But apart from that, there were, like I said, there were people who came, who came in there. And even though I was probably not part of most of them, there were gathering places for talk about the Boston Public Schools. And as we're gearing up after Judge Arthur Garrity's decision to integrate, this was the inter this or to stop the segregation, the de facto segregation in the Boston Public Schools.
Let me just interject something. You came there in 1971. The case, the DeSeg case, was filed in 1972.
That's right.
So were you aware of that at
Yes.
the
Oh
time that
yes.
the
Oh yes. There was the that was the actively discussed. What's interesting is that that was 50 years ago, five
Yes,
zero years ago.
yes, it was.
And I could reflect upon the things that are still haven't been completely solved. There's an there's they're they're just rooted in just rooted in this rooted in the system. And I've often said that you just need to, sometimes we were talking about the T earlier, sometimes you just need to shut it down and start reboot it like you just rebooted your computer. But yes, that was 50 years ago. I was much younger then. Didn't have a enough of a sense of how dangerous the next step of work was going to be. And what I mean by that is, like I'd mentioned that Freedom House was only a few blocks away. And between the Elma Lewis School, we were recruited to volunteer to be bus monitors for the busing that was going to take place in September, at the beginning of the school year, in September of 1974. So we went to Freedom House to be trained as bus monitors.
This was
And
in the summer of
this was in the,
1974.
yes, this was in the summer of 1974. And it was Ellen Jackson who kind of was the coordinator of that training, is the one of the people that I remember. I mean, there were so many people involved. It's only now in recollection that, I recall some of the people who may have been in the room and that I encountered later
Can you
along the way. But
recall some of those folks?
I do recall some of those folks. There was Paul Parks, who was shortly thereafter, he was the educational chair of the NAACP. So those conversations were, whether they were at Freedom House or at Elmer Lewis School of Fine Arts, he was a friend of Miss Lewis's. So like I said, people came and went and discussions were held. So Paul Parks, and then he later, a few years later, became the Secretary of Education. It was Dukakis's Secretary of Education. And as you remember, one connection to JFY is that his daughter Stacy was one of our board members for many years.
She was. Yes, she was. There were some other people around the Elma Lewis School and Freedom House in those days too.
Well, Jean McGuire. And Jean
yeah.
McGuire, I remember from the bus monitor training because she was one.
Was Hubie Jones around at that time?
Hubie was around. Ruth Batson, of course. Tom Atkins, who was a city councilor, and John O'Brien. I actually taught his kids at the school, but John D. O'Brien, after whom the school is named. So
there was a year or two later, as I recall, there was a presidential campaign going on, and
the link that actually brought the presidential candidate there was Mike Dukakis. So because he was running for governor, and that was, he appointed Paul Parks as his educational secretary. The person that he brought to the Elma Lewis School of Fine Arts for a reception was Jimmy Carter.
You mean that peanut farmer?
The peanut farmer. Well, that's what everybody said. No one had heard of him before then. And so that was, that was one of those moments that you don't forget. Jesse Jackson had been there, was there also. Like I said, it was a mecca, and it was one of opportunities were limited for those things. I mean, now you can NAACP can go to the big hotel venues and stuff, but you couldn't then, except for the Parker House. Terry Dunphy was actually on the board of advisors of the Elma Lewis School of Fine Arts. So the Parker House ended up being one of those places. Terry Dunphy, the Dunphy family, were very generous, and that was one of the accommodations. Both incoming artists stayed there, and there were a couple of gatherings there.
You mean, but at other hotels downtown, that was not possible?
Nope.
Why?
They did not cater to the people of the African-American persuasion.
Really? There were segregated hotels in Boston?
Yes.
In the 1970s?
Yeah. Segregation here was often, it was not as dramatic as Louise Day Hicks and her loudspeakers and Pixie Palladino. Some of it was very subtle, like not being able to book major hotel venues. And some of it was based on economics and ignorance about the purchasing power of the Black community. So, well, there's not much of a market, for the same reason that WILD, the radio station, had its broadcast license was only from sun up to sundown.
Really?
Which was much better in the summer.
Yeah.
But
really?
When I was listening to WILD, it was in fact they went off before sundown. It was usually after school you got to listen to it for maybe a couple of hours, and then by 5 o'clock it was done.
Wow.
Again,
I never knew that.
Looking at it was a view of a limited market and difficulties in getting a license, which were, I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but those were the realities in the 60s and 70s. And I think that was why back in the 80s, I don't remember which date, but it was when the first NAACP national conference was here. I don't know if I don't know how many people realized just what a big deal that was. It was a big deal because it was the first time they had applied to well, first of all, Boston just wasn't seen as a place that and it's not. It doesn't have as large a Black population as New York or Chicago or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. But it also had this its bad reputation from busing. People did not want to come here because they saw it as a racist city, because that the busing got so much national publicity, you know. So it's been part of Boston's scandalous reputation as a place to live, particularly for Black people. And it still comes up in conversation if you are trying to get people to come
Was
here.
that 1982, that conference?
It was in the mid 80s. I'm trying
Yeah,
to.
yeah.
Another person present was Bob Schwartz, who
Yeah.
at the time was Kevin
Yeah.
White's education advisor. But they were all around. So let me get to that day, because it was an experience that really, well, it's something I won't forget for sure.
Well,
Part of our
it's
training was to drop to the floor and to get kids on the floor.
well, let's go. Hold on a second. That day, what day are we talking about?
We're talking about September 12th, 1974.
Okay, September 12th, 1974.
1974. It was warm. It was a
Okay.
warm September day, as I recall. The first thing I recall, because it was a thought that stuck in my mind and will remain in my mind, is the courage of the parents. I mean, we were entrusted with the safety of protecting the safety of the children who were getting on the bus.
So was
And
this at
parents,
Freedom House? This is at
it
Freedom
was
House?
around the corner from Freedom House.
All right, so it's September 12th, 1974. What time?
I don't
Eight
know.
7 a.m., 8 a.m.
Seven. Seven. Somewhere between maybe 7, 7:30 a.m. It was school bus boarding
Now
time.
this is a historical moment about
It
which
is a
there's a whole ton
historical
of stuff,
moment for
but
sure.
you were there.
I was there.
Okay.
So
All right.
that's the first thing. That's what I remembered, and I remembered the resolve of of those parents who were there because they felt that this was part, not so much a historic moment, but that the schools were finally going to would be open, that all schools in Boston would be open to all children.
What did you say to the kids as they were getting on the bus? Had the kids been trained previously?
I think so, that at least they had been. Yes, I'm pretty sure they had been. I was not part of that. We
Yeah.
just, we said good morning, ready for the first day of ready for the first day of school. Now, what would be interesting is to find, I don't remember any of them by
What?
name. We did ask their names, and we'd introduced ourselves, and we would be accompanying them. But I think it would really be, I know, Anthony Lucas interviewed three families, but finding some of those children and to get the experience from their side of the story. I mean, it's one thing to be trained to go into a particular situation, and they were quiet mostly, but what were they really f feeling inside?
Well, there must be quite a few of them around. They would be in their 50s now, or maybe
They
in
would
their
be,
early
yes.
60s. They're
I would really love to meet up with them and talk with them and said, here's we con I don't want to say conformed, but we behaved the way we were trained to behave, knowing at least as adults that we were going into a hostile situation. And
How many of you were that? So you were bus monitors. Is that what you were called?
yeah, there were at least two of us on the bus, maybe even three.
That's all?
Yeah, because there actually weren't a lot of everybody who was enrolled to attend school that day did not show up that day.
Was there only one bus?
No, there were three. I'm pretty sure
Okay.
there were three. I'm thinking about, so the buses took us to Day Boulevard,
Yeah.
and then they consolidated the buses and went the rest of the way with a police escort.
From Day Boulevard to
From
where
Day
we
Boulevard, yes, they went with the police escort.
to where were you going?
We were going to the, I want to say, Galvin Middle School.
That sounds about right.
So I
Yeah.
we had I was in the middle school bus, and then there was the high school bus.
Yeah.
But Day Boulevard was the central meeting place. And in the morning, it was, there were, the people had signs, and they had, terrible racial epithets written on them. But by the afternoon, when police escorts again at Day Boulevard, and then put the kids on the bus to come back. We did not have to do the protocol because we did not have rocks at our, thrown at our particular bus, but that was what we were prepared for. And when you have that kind of training, and I would imagine that this was like military training, you're not thinking about lots of other things because you are laser focused on that, keeping the kids safe. And why were we doing this? We were doing this because this was a matter of equal opportunity. This was the theme of the 60s and 70s, and this is what we believed in. I my impressionable years were the years of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. So ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, and service to the community. So that's why you were crazy enough to go into this in the first place, and you had a responsibility. Now, in the afternoon,
So wait, let's before we get to the afternoon. So this, we're
okay.
still in the morning. The bus, you drive to Day Boulevard, nothing happens between
No, there was
Freedom
just a lot,
House.
right? You could hear things in the loudspeakers, and people had bullhorns and whatever. But
Even in Roxbury and Dorchester?
no,
No,
not in
so
Roxbury. Oh no,
no.
this was when
This is
we got
after Day
down
Boulevard.
Dorchester Avenue. I don't even remember the route. I
Morrissey
just
Boulevard. Well, it
remember
must have
getting.
been Morrissey Boulevard.
It must have been Morrissey Boulevard,
Yeah.
and there were lots of people out with, like I said, with loudspeakers and posters and placards and stuff. But by the afternoon, the bars had opened, and the people had a sufficient amount of whatever they were imbibing, and behavior was just a little bit more intense than it was in the morning.
Talk about the rocks.
Well, people were throwing rocks, and we had heard, and we were prepared that they were gonna, as the model for the integration in the South, that the buses were going to be targets. They were going to aim for the windows, and again, did not happen to us. There was one bus that had been struck with two, I think two of the windows that cracked, but not broken. So I don't know why that was the case, whether or not that was the route, and whether or not people were just not close enough. But I think the fact that it was the Day Boulevard was chosen is that even though it was wide open, it was although I remember that there were people on the flat roofs of the houses and buildings there, and that was a little, that gave me a little pause.
And they were doing what?
They were mooning, and worse. You saw things and you read things about desegregation in the South and somehow were given the impression that that didn't happen here. But it did, certainly on a smaller scale. And seeing what human beings, the kind of behavior that human beings are capable of, it was a real eye-opener. And it didn't really, again, laser focus on getting the kids from point A to point B and then from point B back. And then we had a debrief. And then I went home and watched the news and the news coverage. It wasn't until I saw the news coverage that I thought, oh my God, that was really dangerous. And that would, that really was the hot, it was the manifestation of the hostile environment, that you were, that we had been trained for. Again, there was really just laser focus on the task at hand and what to do. So I couldn't tell you the route because I spent most of the time just watching the kids and keeping and ready at any moment to get everyone on the floor, if necessary. So didn't do much sightseeing at the time, but it was a live experience and something you just remember that human beings are capable of this behavior. People did not want the schools to be integrated. And the purpose of the integration to me, and I think, going back and reading the case, was an equality. And I think that that was, and it was equality of resources. And that was mostly achieved, I think, but then the equity issues still remain. And we see it now because we can measure it now in a way that we didn't measure it, or it wasn't measured in the 60s, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, although it was always an issue. It was a continuous issue among the Boston branch of the NAACP. And the office of the Executive Office of Education, and among all of the community organizations, the other community organizations, and it still is. So the one thing I wanted to say about Ellen Jackson, there was a couple of connections here. Ellen Jackson was the founder of the Citywide Parents Council.
Oh,
And
yeah.
so that was another one of those organizations that was always monitoring and with a mission of improving educational opportunities for the Black students. But later, when I was at JFY Networks, we worked with the Citywide Parents Council on a summer program. Yes, Citywide Parents Council. I don't know much about them, haven't heard much about them now since
They don't exist
we had
anymore.
that program. And then there was Sarah Ann Shaw. I think before her career with WBZ, before her reporting career, but she was definitely a community leader. Her daughter Claire was a program officer for both the Boston Globe Foundation and also Liberty Mutual Foundation. She retired a year or so ago from there. So how did I get to JFY Networks? And
No, it's a good question. So
yes.
you're lying on the floor of the bus, and the next thing you know, you're at
Well,
how
JFY
did that
Network,
happen?
how did that happen? Well, it actually happened. Actually happened while I was elsewhere because I had gone to DESE, and that's where I had additional interactions with Paul Parks.
DESE for the just for the
I
case of
forget what it was
the
called then, but now
it
it's
was
the
the Department of
Department of Education.
Education. It was just the Department
It
of
was definitely the
Education.
Department of Education.
They hadn't divided it.
It wasn't elementary and secondary education. It was just the Department
No,
of Education. And
and it included higher ed and early childhood.
right. And the position that I was working was actually funded with CETA funds. So it was the college, it was college and career before it was college and career.
CETA is Comprehensive Employment and Training
Comprehensive
Act.
Employment and Training Act. But anyway, that money was federal money, but
Eighty
it also
something.
came, it had a formula, a local formula, and then where some of it went to the city of Boston, and those were under the control of Joe Duggan, if you recall Joe Duggan.
I don't. Who was Joe Duggan? Was
Joe
he at?
Duggan was in the Kevin White administration, and he was the workforce, or as they called it, manpower. That was the Department of Manpower, something or another. So they got some of the money, and they got the lion's share of the money. But the Department of Education also got some money. And that seemed like an interesting job, and it had some interesting aspects to it because it was the nexus of education and training and, skills, academic skills, workforce skills. So from there, I went to graduate school because I was more interested in policy. And I went to Brandeis because didn't know about Brandeis, but Paul Parks's undersecretary, Joe Warren, was he, yes, he was there, and he was a student. He was working on his doctorate at the Heller School. And what I liked about the Heller School, because I'd been looking at both business schools and public policy schools and education schools. And the Heller School seemed to have a combination of both less emphasis on the education, but it was that social justice underlying theme that was the most important to me. And I thought, gee, why haven't I hadn't heard of this? And that was that. But and then I had a couple of other jobs, but I was looking for sort of the next education step and whether or not I get another master's degree or not. But so I started taking some random courses, and one of them was with a fundraiser, Dwight Luth. And Dwight was one of Dwight's clients was Jobs for Youth. And I told him that I was in the I was working as a development director at for a Quaker school, and I told him that I was in the job market, and he said, "Oh, well, Jobs for Youth is looking for someone, and I'm actually scouting for a development position there. So why don't if you're interested, apply." So I did a little research. We hadn't quite gotten to the internet yet. I thought, well, it's got the mission that I like the mission. It's that, it's that education skills, job skills. I like what they're doing. I'll apply for the job, and kind of the rest is history in that respect. But I think the equity question has always been there. It's been in the programs that we've run, and also underlying what we're doing, particularly now using technology. And I think the sort of the difference in the equality piece is that, all right, every child is given a computer or a laptop. But are the outcomes equal given the circumstances? So let's say, even though we're working in the classroom, does every student have Wi-Fi access at home? Is everyone, and we look at the different when we're looking at the different populations, does everybody have English as their first language? does everybody have learning differences and learn, you know, what differences in learning styles? I was going to say equally, is everyone equally abled? No. So the equity piece is designing inputs, interventions that will ensure that the outcomes are equal, even though each child may have the same textbook or computer. But so that's sort of that's sort of the simple equality, equity of discussion. But even though we know that we know from the years of work that we've put into it that it's not quite that simple. In fact, it's not simple at all. But you have to be willing to do it. And I think that's why we do this work.
How do you see what JFY does now, or what has happened, say, over the past 10 or 15 years, as contributing to that question of equity and equality?
Well, on one level, I'm thinking about the learning loss question and the successes that we've had that we've documented in terms of closing that, if you want to call it the pandemic slip or whatever it is, but it is about learning loss and how not being in school affected different populations differently. That is certainly an example of equity questions, and we've made some impact on that, but in East Boston and also at Northeast Metro Tech. Post-pandemic, we're still kind of in recovery from that. That the fact that we've been able to have some impact at Northeast Metro, in particular, if you want to slice down to the Black student population there, which is smaller than it is in Boston, but nevertheless, we had impactful results in closing the Black-white achievement gap at Northeast Metro Tech. So focusing on those measures, like I said, we are now able to have some metrics to see if we're making impact or to feel like we're making impact. And I think that that's, some years are better than others, but those are the things we celebrate when we see them, So I know that standardized testing and metrics is a, you know, is a big controversial topic, but it's really helpful to be able to measure things, but not just measure them, but really to do something about it. And I think we just keep at it. It's a huge problem. We're working on our piece of it, and we'd like to solve it for everybody. But if we can solve our piece, there'll at least be some satisfaction. So that's what brought me here, and that's what, quite frankly, that's what keeps me here, even in the cyberspace that we're in. But again, back to JFY's mission of finding tools to address equity questions. So with AI and improving writing, again, we can have a tool, but we're also, so that's, let's give everybody the tool. But then how do we use it to ensure positive outcomes
Well,
for students?
I think the point to make is that for the
And tech,
past,
yeah. So
it's about
yes, so the past 20 something years, we've been using technology as a tool, and this is the latest iteration of technology for achieving educational equity.
but the fact that we're using it and developing, we already have it in operation. We're developing tools. It's our ability to move quickly and adjust to changing circumstances. And it takes something like AI, or 20 years ago, something like computer-based instruction, and put it into effect while school districts cannot move, can't move
Right,
that
well, we're
fast.
putting it into effect for a reason, not
Oh,
just for
cool.
its own set. We JFY
Oh,
is,
yeah.
we're putting, there's still the reason. There's still the, it's mission driven.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah,
mission
yeah.
driven and taking advantage of the market. It's not solely market driven. You know, I have to say that taking advantage of market opportunities, but there's a mission. It's still mission driven.
Well, Paula, this has been a very interesting discussion, taking us all the way back to the early days of the equity issue in Boston. It's an appropriate topic to be talking about in Black History Month because, in many ways, Black history in Boston is the history of school desegregation and the whole campaign for educational equity. That's history. So, thank you
That
very
is, and it's
much.
been 50 years, and
Yeah, no
at least
kidding.
if you're making progress towards the goal, you know,
I'd
it would be
say.
nice to know, you know, now as a grandmother. I mean, I was a, you know,
Yeah, yeah.
I was a young, you know, I was a young person then with lots of energy, but as a grandmother, you
Still with
know,
lots of energy.
I would like to see some real change and not give up on the, you know, we've been through, you know, presidents and governors and congressional, the majorities and elected school committees, appointed school committees, real change. Just keep working towards real change, real equity, and hope that future generations will benefit from it. And also, I guess in reflection as a, you know, now that I'm in a senior citizen, that change does take time. You know, 50 years seems like a very long time if you've lived through it and saying, why is it, you know, why hasn't this been solved? But if you look through periods of history, it does take many years, sometimes several generations, for the real impact to, you know, for the real impact to be realized. So I'm hopeful about that, even
I
though
guess we're.
I may not be around to see it. Much of the resistance will be from people who don't understand the history at all. But
Yeah.
it, you know, but the, and there has been progress. I just really,
Yeah.
even though understanding that real change takes a lot of time, you get impatient because you want to see things, and you're still seeing sort of, you know, the residual
Yeah.
of conditions that were, reading the cases from back in the 50s and 60s, a lot of the focus was on the buildings. Some
Yeah.
of those buildings are still some of those buildings are still around.
That's
This
right.
is the school buildings. They're
Yeah,
still
yeah.
around, and they're still trying to figure out what to do with them and about them and about the fact that children are still going to school in, you know, in buildings with lead paint, faulty heating and no cooling,
Yeah.
lead in the water, in addition to other problems that, you know, contemporary problems. Like
Yeah.
drugs and weapons and assaults and COVID. But the
Yeah.
again, some of those issues still remain. And
Well, Hubie thinks there's been progress.
I think that there has been. And he would know, he was, you know, he was there. And I would agree with them. I'm not saying that there's been no progress. I'm just saying that there's still a long way to go. And let's not lose sight of the fact that we can't say that, oh, well, we solved this problem, we don't have to worry about it anymore. And I think that was a mistake that was made in policy. It's like, oh, we're done with that. You know, the schools are desegregated, we're good. Well, no, we're not good. We've got a long way to go, and progress has been made for sure. But more progress needs to be made. Let's not lose sight of what we still need to do.
Well, thank you again for spending
My
this time with
pleasure.
us. And we will, I'm sure we'll continue the conversation.
We would like to thank JFY's Deputy Director, Paula Paris, for joining us this month for the JFY Networks podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free educational resources, including these monthly podcasts, to support all education communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.